when we all come together to really celebrate who we ultimately are as people, it's an especially great day to be Indigenous.
Celebrating the state's second annual Indigenous Peoples Day from Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, October 8th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, the challenges the large interior coal industry faces in the future.
Oh yeah, we're under pressure to move away from coal. It would be naive to say anything differently.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. Want a fulfilling volunteer opportunity educating and protecting your community? As a trained Medicare counselor, you'll help stop fraud and connect people with the benefits they've earned. You can make a powerful difference for Alaska seniors. Learn more at medicare.alaska.gov or call Alaska's Medicare Information Office at 800-478-6065. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The chairman of the Alaska Republican Party says he's shocked Senator Lisa Murkowski opposed the confirmation of Justice Brett Kavanaugh, and he's vowing the party will have a significant response. Tuckerman Babcock says he'll leave it to the party's state central committee to decide what action to take against the Republican senator. Murkowski told reporters after the vote that her opposition was based on what she thought was best for the credibility of the Supreme Court and the country, not on politics.
There are consequences, but if I were to worry every day about political repercussions or somebody saying that they're going to run against me or say something in a newspaper story, I wouldn't be able to do the job that Alaskans expect me to do.
Murkowski is also getting flack from liberals for participating in what's called a vote pair so that Republican Senator Steve Daines could stay at his daughter's wedding in Montana. Murkowski said she changed her no vote to present on Saturday to offset the yes vote that Daines would have cast if he had to fly back to Washington. The final vote was 50-48 with one present. Murkowski says her vote pair didn't affect the outcome and was a gesture toward the civility she'd like to see more of in the Senate.
Every little small baby step that we can take to be more civil and more gracious and more generous with one another makes us better senators and it makes us better human beings.
Murkowski is not up for re-election until 2022. The Alaska Public Offices Commission on Friday found the Republican Governors Association violated state election law. The commission said the violation occurred when the RGA reserved TV time for political advertisements without registering with the state. The commission also found that the group Families for Alaska's Future, Dunleavy, violated the law when it reserved TV ad time before it registered. The commission ordered the RGA to register with the commission. It ordered Families for Alaska's Future, Dunleavy, to file accurate reports, and it ordered both groups to pay fines of $4,450. It could adjust the penalties at the next commission meeting. The commission order was the result of a complaint by the campaign of Governor Bill Walker and Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott. Mike Dunleavy, the Republican gubernatorial candidate, won an endorsement today from one of the largest police unions in the state. The Public Safety Employees Association represents Alaska state and wildlife troopers and officers at several police departments around the state. The union has more than 800 members. In a letter to Dunleavy announcing the endorsement, Union President Doug Massey says public safety appears to be Dunleavy's number one priority. The 500-plus member Anchorage Police Department Employees Association announced its support for Democrat Mark Begich earlier this fall. An oft-cited trend in the lower 48 is that coal plants are closing, in large part due to the availability of cheaper natural gas. But in the interior of Alaska, that picture looks different. Last year, almost 40% of the interior's electrical generation came from coal, and the area is home to the only coal power plant built in the United States since 2015. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Ravenna Koenig has this story exploring why coal has hung on in the interior and what challenges there may be on the horizon.
On a sunny day at the end of August, University of Alaska Fairbanks Chancellor Dan White stood on a dais at the edge of campus. he addressed a crowd of people who had shown up to celebrate the completion of UAF's coal-fired power plant, expected to come online in November.
This is the university where the world-class research for all of the Arctic is done, and we can't do that without a reliable supply of heat and power.
Instead of a ribbon cutting, there was a switch to flip, prompting light bulbs that spelled out UAF to jump to life. This power plant is a big deal to UAF, considering its old one was in danger of failing. But it also has a more symbolic significance. In a decade when hundreds of coal plants have been retired across the United States, UAF's reinvestment in coal shows just how different things are in Alaska's interior. Why is it different here? One of the big factors is that even after decades of talk about getting affordable natural gas to the interior, Fairbanks as of yet has only a limited supply of natural gas. And unlike many other places in the country, it's not price competitive with coal.
There's an ad at the Fairbanks Economic Development Corp from the Newsminer, gas is coming. It's from the 1958 Newsminer.
That's Brian Rogers, the former chancellor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, who was part of the team that explored fuel options for the new plant. They looked at a slew of them, including trying to get natural gas.
I didn't particularly want to go with nuclear. We looked at it. I would have loved to have gone with natural gas. We don't have it. Oil would have been super expensive. There's not enough solar to heat a university campus in the middle of winter.
He says that coal wasn't their first choice, mostly due to its higher CO2 emissions. But when they narrowed the field down to the types of energy that were available, feasible, and affordable, coal won. Hands down. UAF's is one of six power plants that rely on coal in the interior. All of that energy comes from the Usabelli coal mine, which is 2 hours' drive from Fairbanks and just 10 miles north of Denali National Park. In the small town of Healy, where most employees of the mine live, there's a turnoff that winds its way back into a valley surrounded by gently sloping hills and to the gate of the mine.
Just drive on the left-hand side of the road, and we're 4 miles up the Hall Road.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Come on in.
Usabelli is the only operating coal mine in the state of Alaska and has been owned by the Healy-based Usabelli family for 75 years.
Emil Usabelli came to Alaska in the 30s, and he actually first started in the Matanuska coal fields, and then he moved up here to the interior, and in 1943 started Usabelli Coal Mine.
That's Lorelei Simon, Vice President of External Affairs for the mine. Simon says Usabelli's operation is pretty small when you compare it to most coal mines in the lower 48. The company employs about 100 people and produces around 1 million tons of coal a year. In 2011, their production was over twice that, but has dropped since, mostly due to a declining export market. On the other hand, local demand recently went up. Just last month, the local electric utility, Golden Valley Electric Association, brought a previously built coal plant online, upping the percentage of their coal-generated electricity from about 30% to over 65%. So that's the way things are. But what about the future? Are you under pressure to move away from coal?
Oh yeah, we're under pressure to move away from coal. It would be naive to say anything differently.
Corey Borgeson is president and CEO of Golden Valley Electric Association.
There is a drive to reduce CO2 emissions. So how does that affect the future of coal in the interior and at Golden Valley? I would say if you're a futurist here and you're looking at where things are going, you're going to see a reduction in the production of power from coal.
Borgeson thinks Golden Valley could move in that direction by expanding their renewables and battery technology, perhaps collaborating with other rail belt utilities. He also thinks there's a possibility that natural gas could become a more economical option as the Interior Gas Utility moves forward with their efforts to expand gas supply in Fairbanks. But for the moment at least, the equation still doesn't add up to an imminent challenge to coal. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Ravenna Koenig in Fairbanks.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, praise and opposition over what could be one of the largest gold mines in the world.
Basically, we're moving one mountain to another and taking out the gold in the process.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
monthly marijuana tax revenue in Alaska hit $1.5 million in August. The state says the only time this year that tax revenue was below $1 million was in February. The Department of Revenue says about $15.8 million has been collected since October 2016, when the first legal sales began. State law calls for half of the tax revenue to go toward programs aimed at reducing repeat criminal offenders. Legislation passed earlier this year calls for an additional 25% to go toward a marijuana education and treatment program. Megan Topcock has won her appeal to the Nome City Council and will go on to hold City Council Seat D. In last Tuesday's municipal election, Topcock won 58% of the vote, but had her eligibility challenged on grounds of residency by one of her opponents. The challenge claimed Topcock was not eligible for office under the Nome Code of Ordinances because she had not established 1 year of residency prior to her election. Topcock appealed the challenge in a public hearing.
In cases where there is a statutory ambiguity as to whether or not a candidate is eligible to run for office, the statute should be construed in favor of eligibility, so long as it may reasonably be read so. I think it's very reasonable, and I think that there's a lot of people here who agree that it's a very reasonable interpretation of that ordinance, that it doesn't require the 12 months immediately prior.
Topcock moved to Nome after graduating from Dartmouth College, establishing residency from 2013 to 2014 before she left to attend law school at the University of Oregon. At the time, she was employed locally and had established a post office box and utility bills. After graduation, Topcock returned to Nome upon obtaining employment at Kowarik and reestablished permanent residency in June of 2018. She noted that the Nome Code of Ordinances does not specifically state that residency be established for the year immediately preceding election to the city council. Five of the six council members were present and all voted to accept Topcock's appeal that she had established the required residency even if it was not in the year immediately prior to her election. One of the biggest gold mines in the world could be built along the Kuskokwim River north of Bethel. The Donlin mine has so far escaped the intense level of public scrutiny aimed at the Pebble mine, but it's much farther along the permitting process. Supporters say the mine would bring much-needed jobs to the region, while opponents worry it threatens their subsistence way of life. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Christy Schallenberger reports.
To visit the proposed Donlin mine site, you have to take a small plane. I toured the site in July with Kurt Parkin, the spokesman for Donlin Gold, which is the company developing the mine. Donlin organized and paid for the flight.
Yay, we made it.
Yeah. So is this Donlin?
There isn't much at the site. It's just a long airstrip with clusters of sturdy buildings in the middle of green mountains close to the Kuskokwim River. Donlin wrapped up most of its exploration before 2012. But workers continued the environmental testing and monitoring water quality as the company worked with the Army Corps of Engineers to wrap up its lengthy environmental review. But now...
And the camp is closed now while we're finishing up the permitting process.
We get in a helicopter to see the rest of the extensive mine site.
Clear.
Right now, it's mostly dense black spruce forest, but Donlin's proposal would turn this area into a large open pit mine. That means Donlin will dig two big holes that will eventually merge together to form a large pit. At its peak, the pit will be more than a mile wide and 2 miles long. After we get off the helicopter, Parkin says the mine would be in the top 10% in the world for a gold mine, because of its deposit size and production.
Basically, we're moving one mountain to another and taking out the gold in the process.
The site sits in one of the most remote regions in Alaska, so Donlin will have to build roads, a long gas pipeline, a power plant, a port, and an airstrip for its operations. That means the project will disrupt 2,800 acres of wetlands. And to do that, Donlin needs about 100 permits from federal and state agencies. Donlin supporters argue that the mine would bring jobs to a region with high unemployment and poverty. Bethel resident Moses Tulum says that the Donlin mine will open up economic opportunities in the villages.
You go to just about any village, you will name basically about the same number of employers or identify the same number of employers in that village.
Tulum was born in Chivek, but has lived in Bethel on and off for the past decade. He's seen people leave the villages to find work and not return. He says jobs could keep young people in the villages.
Younger people will be looking at relatives working in the mining industry, and they'll have role models that they'll be looking up to who have good paying jobs and able to afford more things like snow machines, boats, and help supporting their subsistence way of life.
But many in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta have big concerns about the mine. They worry that the extra barge traffic will damage spawning grounds for smelt and chum. And some fear that a mine accident would contaminate the Kuskokwim River. The First Tribe in the YK Delta marched against the proposed mine this past summer in Bethel.
No Donlin!
And a local working group formed to oppose it as well. But most of the protests are local. Unlike the Pebble Mine in Bristol Bay, Donlin has a lot of political support in Alaska. The three gubernatorial candidates have endorsed it. Crooked Creek is the village closest to the mine. Its traditional council endorsed the mine in a resolution 10 years ago. But some people in the community have concerns. Mishka Andrianov is a Yupik elder who lives in Crooked Creek. He doesn't like the mine.
We get that mine open, I don't know if we will get any more fish up this river or not, because that's our life, the fish and the... I live off the land, I don't... Yeah, I do fishing and trapping and hunting when I can.
Andrianov says he worked for Donlin during its early exploration days. He used to hunt and trap in the mine site area before the company closed it down. He's afraid the mine could bring in more people than the village can handle.
We're having problems with alcohol and all of that, and it'll be more than that when the mine opens up.
Kurt Parkin, with Donlin Gold, says the company understands those concerns. And he says Donlin will build the mine safely. Parkin can't say when the mine is likely to break ground, but says it's years away. Now, the mine is moving through the permitting phase, getting its environmental impact statement and major permits this year.
We just received our federal permits, and so that's probably the biggest milestone to date. So with the federal permits in hand, we're continuing to work towards getting our major state permit.
Donlin expects to get most of those this year. But Donlin will need to determine if gold prices are high enough to begin building the mine. An analyst with financial firm S&P Global says the current gold market is pretty good for development and will likely stay that way for a while. Parkin says the company already invested $500 million in exploration and the permitting process. He says that means Donlin is serious about developing the mine. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Christy Schallenberger.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
What if free speech and civility could coexist? Join the University of Alaska on October 12th for a public discussion of this timely topic. The forum will feature a noon presentation by the author of the book Free Speech on Campus, Erwin Chemerinsky, as well as the Seawolf debate team, taking up the topic of whether the future of democracy depends on limiting free speech. Friday, October 12th at the UAA Fine Arts Building. The event begins at 11 a.m. For more or to live stream the forum, go to www.alaska.edu/freespeech. This message sponsored by University of Alaska.
Today is Indigenous Peoples Day in Alaska, and there are gatherings across the state commemorating and celebrating Alaska Native people. In Anchorage, Alaska Pacific University held a celebration with food, dancing, and cultural activities. Among the speakers at the event were Governor Bill Walker, Anchorage Mayor Ethan Berkowitz, and State Health Commissioner Valerie Naharaluk Davidson. Davidson says it gives her immense pride to see Native people from around the state celebrating their culture and heritage.
As a Yupik person, I think every day is a great day to be Indigenous, but on days like today, Indigenous Peoples Day, when we all come together to really celebrate who we ultimately are as people, it's an especially great day to be Indigenous.
Recently, Governor Walker issued an order recognizing the danger that Alaska Native languages are in. By some estimates, many Native languages could be extinct by the year 2100. The order works to increase partnerships between government and tribal organizations, integrate Native languages into schools, and update public signs to include both English and Indigenous names. Davidson says these steps help preserve Native culture.
When our children know who they are, when they speak their language and their culture is ingrained in their everyday life, that builds resiliency in children, and we have much better outcomes for our children and families when we know exactly who we are as people.
Several speakers touched on the high rates of violence against Native women, including the recent murder of 10-year-old Ashley Johnson Barr in Kotzebue. In her remarks, Davidson spoke of her own experiences with abuse as a child. She says the high rates of violence against Native women creates a negative stigma about village life. Despite the sometimes tough subject matter, the overall tone of the celebration was optimistic, complete with food and tribal dancing. Celebrations were also held at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and the Alaska State Museum in Juneau. Governor Bill Walker's advisory panel tasked with recommending ways to relax the U.S. Forest Service's roadless rule is taking public comment across Southeast Alaska. As Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick reports, the crowd in Juneau supported keeping the roadless rule intact in the Tongass National Forest.
Governor Bill Walker appointed the 12-member advisory committee to make recommendations to the state on where roads could be built inside 7.4 million acres of roadless areas in the Tongass National Forest. In Juneau, more than 24 people told the committee they didn't like the idea of rolling back the roadless rule. Folks like retired federal research chemist Jeff Short.
Expanding roadless areas to make access for logging in Southeast Alaska amounts to a government subsidy of private industry.
Juneau resident Carl Broderson complained that the hearing was announced with little warning and held in the middle of a workday.
It's akin to holding a vote on a salmon issue during a king opening.
Fly fishing guide Mark Hieronymus was among those in the tourism industry who have argued for keeping the roadless rule. He said people from the lower 48 come to Southeast Alaska
in greater and growing numbers for the incredible fishing opportunity and natural roadless setting still enjoyed here in the Tongass.
A pair of supporters for more access also spoke out. One of them was Ketchikan City Councilman Dick Coos.
I feel like I'm a weird duck sitting in here listening to all these people that really don't know much about what's going on out there, but that's beside the point. I'm a retired Forest Service, 35 years.
Coos was Ketchikan's district ranger in the 1980s. He said there's room for managed development in the Tongass.
And my goal is very simple. You manage a healthy forest, you have healthy communities, and you have healthy businesses.
State Forester Chris Mache presides over the advisory committee.
Certainly the weight of the testimony that we heard was not to change the rule, or in some cases even to provide more protection.
The state of Alaska fought the nationwide 2001 roadless rule in federal court. The Bush administration granted an exemption, but the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals struck it down in 2011. The state of Alaska's appeal, filed last year, is pending in the D.C. Circuit Court. Mache said that makes the state's position very clear. It's against the roadless rule.
And one way or the other, the state's been engaged in trying to overturn the rule since the day it was put in place.
But on the ground, the federal roadless rule is polarizing in Southeast Alaska.
There's a lot of passion around this issue.
Brian Holst heads the Juneau Economic Development Council and sits on the advisory committee. He said the group hopes to find some compromise. The historic fight has been between keeping the roadless rule intact or doing away with it altogether.
So our task is not to endorse either of those sides, because both of those options are out there, but is to generate alternatives somewhere in the middle. And that's challenging. That will be challenging.
The panel doesn't have much time to deliberate. It's charged with crafting an Alaska-specific rule that would keep some areas roadless while accommodating areas for road building and development, principally logging, all before the end of next month. But before that happens, it'll convene and hold public hearings in both Ketchikan later this month and in Sitka early next month. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game released its summary of the 2018 Chinook salmon season last week. The Board of Fish already declared it a disaster, then the governor declared an economic disaster in August. This report from Fish and Game confirms that the entire fishery only brought about $3,000 between the six permit holders who fished. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
The overall sockeye salmon run to the Chinook River was 540,000 fish. That's the lowest return on record since statehood. There were no commercial fishing opportunities for sockeye this summer in the Chinook management area in an effort to get more fish upriver to spawn. Just over 100 reds were caught incidentally during a two-day opener in July aimed at harvesting pink and chum salmon. The Chinook River gets two individual salmon runs, an early run and a late run. The late run actually made its minimum escapement goal, but barely. The early run, on the other hand, only hit about half of its escapement goal of 350,000 sockeye. So the sockeye return was a disaster. How did the other species of salmon fare? To paint with a broad brush, not well. In terms of harvest, there was a second 48-hour commercial fishing opener targeting silvers in September. One coho was caught. Over the last 10 years, fishermen have brought in an average of 111,000 coho. During the July two-day opener targeting pinks and chum, fishermen brought in 6 pinks and 924 chum. Normally, fishermen get 702,000 pinks during pink years and 253,000 chum annually. There were no openings for Chinook. In terms of escapement, coho escapement was actually above average. Chum salmon escapement was below the escapement goal, but Fish and Game noted the weather was poor for surveying, and if conditions were better, they would likely have counted enough chum to meet the escapement goal. The pink run was weak. According to Fish and Game, the Chinook management area only counted about a quarter of its minimum escapement goal, 170,000 pinks. The King run was also very poor. Only 825 Chinook made it upstream to spawn. The bottom end of the escapement goal is 1,300 kings. State subsistence fishing and sport fishing for Chinook was closed on July 13th to try to get more upriver. Overall, the summary confirms what fishermen in the area have been saying since early summer. It was an extremely rough year. The average value for each permit in the Chinook management area has been above $100,000 for the past 10 years, sometimes double or triple that, and usually more than 50 permit holders fish. This year, only 6 permit holders fished during the 4 days open to fishing. The average value they brought in was a mere $500 per permit. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Ravenna Koenig in Fairbanks, Emily Hofstetter in Nome, Christy Schallenberger in Bethel, and Avery Lill in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com.
What if free speech and civility could coexist? Join the University of Alaska on October 12th for a public discussion of this timely topic. The forum will feature a noon presentation by the author of the book Free Speech on Campus, Erwin Chemerinsky, as well as the Seawolf debate team, taking up the topic of whether the future of democracy depends on limiting free speech. Friday, October 12th at the UAA Fine Arts Building. The event begins at 11 a.m. For more or to live stream the forum, go to www.alaska.edu/freespeech. This message sponsored by University of Alaska.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.